or insecure, less independent, easier to sell. These young people could be told that, by buying the right things, they could achieve middle-class status without work or study. The keep-up-with-the-Joneses cell would work again. The individuality and independence which American women had been getting from education and work outside the home was not such a problem with the teenage brides. In fact, the survey said, if the pattern of happiness through things could be established when these women were young enough, they could be safely encouraged to go out and get a part-time job to help their husbands pay for all the things they buy. The main point now was to convince the teenagers that happiness through things is no longer the prerogative of the rich or the talented. It can be enjoyed by all if they learn the right way, the way the others do it, if they learn the embarrassment of being different. In the words of one of these reports, 49% of the new brides were teenagers, and more girls marry at the age of 18 than at any other age. This early family formation yields a larger number of young people who are on the threshold of their own responsibilities and decision-making in purchases. But the most important fact is of a psychological nature. Marriage today is not only the culmination of a romantic attachment. More consciously and more clear-headedly than in the past, it is also a decision to create a partnership in establishing a comfortable home, equipped with a great number of desirable products. In talking to scores of young couples and brides-to-be, we found that, as a rule, their conversations and dreams centered to a very large degree around their future homes and their furnishings, around shopping to get an idea, around discussing the advantages and disadvantages of various products. The modern bride is deeply convinced of the unique value of married love, of the possibilities of finding real happiness in marriage, and of fulfilling her personal destiny in it and through it. But the engagement period today is a romantic, dreamy, and heady period only to a limited extent. It is probably safe to say that the period of engagement tends to be a rehearsal of the material duties and responsibilities of marriage. While waiting for the nuptials, couples work hard, put aside money for definite purchases, or even begin buying on an installment plan. What is the deeper meaning of this new combination of an almost religious belief in the importance and beauty of married life on the one hand, and the product-centered outlook on the other? The modern bride seeks as a conscious goal that which in many cases her grandmother saw as a blind fate and her mother as slavery. To belong to a man, to have a home and children of her own, to choose among all possible careers the career of wife, mother, homemaker. The fact that the young bride now seeks in her marriage complete fulfillment, that she now expects to prove her own worth and find all the fundamental meanings of life in her home, and to participate through her home in the interesting ideas of the modern era, the future, has enormous practical applications, advertisers were told. For all these meanings she seeks in her marriage, even her fear that she will be left behind can be channeled into the purchase of products. For example, a manufacturer of sterling silver, a product that is very difficult to sell, was told, reassure her that only with sterling can she be fully secure in her new role. It symbolizes her success as a modern woman. Above all, dramatize the fun and pride that derive from the job of cleaning silver. Stimulate the pride of achievement. How much pride you get from the brief task that's so much fun. Concentrate on the very young teenage girls, this report further advised. The young ones will want what the others want, even if their mothers don't. As one of our teenagers said, all the gang has started their own sets of sterling. We're real keen about it, compare patterns and go through the ads together. My own family never had any sterling, and they think I'm showing off when I spend my money on it. They think plated's just as good, but the kids think they're way off base. Get them in schools, churches, sororities, social clubs. Get them through home economics teachers, group leaders, teenage TV programs, and teenage advertising. This is the big market of the future, and word-of-mouth advertising, along with group pressure, is not only the most potent influence, but in the absence of tradition, a most necessary one. As for the more independent older wife, that unfortunate tendency to use materials that require a little care, stainless steel, plastic dishes, paper napkins, can be met by making her feel guilty about the effects on the children. As one young wife told us, I'm out of the house all day long, so I can't prepare and serve meals the way I want to. I don't like it that way. My husband and the children deserve a better break. Sometimes I think it'd be better if we tried to get along on one salary and have a real home life, but there are always so many things we need. Such guilt, the report maintained, can be used to make her see the product, silver, as a means of holding the family together. It gives added psychological value. What's more, the product can even fill the housewife's need for identity, suggests that it becomes truly a part of you, reflecting you. Do not be afraid to suggest mystically that Sterling will adapt itself to any house and any person. The fur industry is in trouble, another survey reported, because young high school and college girls equate fur coats with uselessness and a kept woman. Again, the advice was to get to the very young before these unfortunate connotations have formed. By introducing youngsters to positive fur experiences, the probabilities of easing their way into garment purchasing in their teens is enhanced. Point out that the wearing of a fur garment actually establishes femininity and sexuality for a woman. It's the kind of thing a girl looks forward to. It means something. It's feminine. I'm bringing my daughter up right. She always wants to put on mommy's coat. She'll want them. She's a real girl. But keep in mind that mink has contributed a negative feminine symbolism to the whole fur market. Unfortunately, 2 out of 3 women felt mink wearers were predatory, exploitive, dependent, socially non-productive. Femininity today cannot be so explicitly predatory, exploitative, the report said, nor can it have the old high fashion connotations of stand out from the crowd, self-centeredness. And so fur's ego orientation must be reduced and replaced with the new femininity of the housewife, for whom ego orientation must be translated into togetherness, family orientation. Begin to create the feeling that fur is a necessity, a delightful necessity, thus providing the consumer with moral permission to purchase something she now feels is ego-oriented. Give fur femininity a broader character, developing some of the following status and prestige symbols: an emotionally happy woman, wife and mother who wins the affection and respect of her husband and her children because of the kind of person she is and the kind of role she performs. Place furs in a family setting. Show the pleasure and admiration of a fur garment derived by family members, husband, and children, their pride in their mother's appearance, in her ownership of a fur garment. Develop fur garments as family gifts. Enable the whole family to enjoy that garment at Christmas, etc., thus reducing its ego orientation for the owner and eliminating her guilt over her alleged self-indulgence. Thus, the only way that the young housewife was supposed to express herself and not feel guilty about it was in buying products for the home and family. Any creative urges she may have should also be home and family oriented, as still another survey reported to the home sewing industry. Such activities as sewing achieve a new meaning and a new status. Sewing is no longer associated with absolute need. Moreover, with the moral elevation of home-oriented activities, sewing, along with cooking, gardening, and home decorating, is recognized as a means of expressing creativity and individuality, and also as a means of achieving the quality which a new taste level dictates. The women who sew, the survey discovered, are the active, energetic, intelligent modern housewives, the new home-oriented modern American women who have a great unfulfilled need to create and achieve and realize their own individuality, which must be filled by some home activity. The big problem for the home sewing industry was that the image of sewing was too dull. Somehow it didn't achieve the feeling of creating something important. In selling their products, the industry must emphasize the lasting creativeness of sewing. But even sewing can't be too creative, too individual, according to the advice offered to one pattern manufacturer. His patterns required some intelligence to follow, left quite a lot of room for individual expression, and the manufacturer was in trouble for that very reason. His patterns implied that a woman would know what she likes and would probably have definite ideas. He was advised to widen this far too limited fashion personality and get one with fashion conformity, appeal to the fashion insecure woman, the conformist element in fashion who feels it is not smart to be dressed too differently. For, of course, the manufacturer's problem was not to satisfy woman's need for individuality, for expression or creativity, but to sell more patterns, which is better done by building conformity. Time and time again, the surveys shrewdly analyzed the needs and even the secret frustrations of the American housewife. And each time, if these needs were properly manipulated, she could be induced to buy more things. In 1957, a survey told the department stores that their role in this new world was not only to sell the housewife, but to satisfy her need for education, to satisfy the yearning she has alone in her house to feel herself a part of the changing world. The store will sell her more, the report said, if it will understand that the real need she is trying to fill by shopping is not anything she can buy there. Most women have not only a material need, but a psychological compulsion to visit department stores. They live in comparative isolation. Their vista and experiences are limited. They know that there is a vaster life beyond the horizon, and they fear that life will pass them by. Department stores break down that isolation. The woman entering a department store suddenly has the feeling she knows what is going on in the world. Department stores, more than magazines, TV, or any other medium of mass communication, are most women's main source of information about the various aspects of life. There are many needs that the department store must fill, this report continued. For one, the housewives need to learn and to advance in life. We symbolize our social position by the objects with which we surround ourselves. A woman whose husband was making $6,000 a few years ago and is making $10,000 now needs to learn a whole new set of symbols. Department stores are her best teachers of this subject. For another, there is the need for achievement, which for the new modern housewife is primarily filled by a bargain. We have found that in our economy of abundance, preoccupation with prices is not so much a financial as a psychological need for the majority of women. Increasingly, a bargain means not that I can now buy something which I cannot afford at a higher price. It mainly means I'm doing a good job as a housewife. I'm contributing to the welfare of the family just as my husband does when he works and brings home the paycheck. The price itself hardly matters, the report said. Since buying is only the climax of a complicated relationship, based to a large extent on the woman's yearning to know how to be a more attractive woman, a better housewife, a superior mother, etc., use this motivation in all your promotion and advertising. Take every opportunity to explain how your store will help her fulfill her most cherished roles in life. If the stores are women's school of life, ads are the textbooks. They have an inexhaustible avidity for these ads, which give them the illusion that they are in contact with what is going on in the world of inanimate objects, objects through which they express so much of so many of their drives. Again, in 1957, a survey very correctly reported that despite the many positive aspects of the new home-centered era, unfortunately too many needs were now centered on the home, that home was not able to fill. A cause for alarm? No, indeed. Even these needs are grist for manipulation. The family is not always the psychological pot of gold at the end of the rainbow of promise of modern life, as it has sometimes been represented. In fact, psychological demands are being made upon the family today which it cannot fulfill. Fortunately for the producers and advertisers of America, and also for the family and the psychological well-being of our citizens, much of this gap may be filled, and is being filled, by the acquisition of consumer goods. Hundreds of products fulfill a whole set of psychological functions that producers and advertisers should know of and use in the development of more effective sales approaches. Just as producing once served as an outlet for social tension, now consumption serves the same purpose. The buying of things drains away those needs which cannot really be satisfied by home and family. the housewife's need for something beyond themselves with which to identify. A sense of movement with others toward aims that give meaning and purpose to life. An unquestioned social aim to which each individual can devote his efforts. Deeply set in human nature is the need to have a meaningful place in a group that strives for meaningful social goals. Whenever this is lacking, the individual becomes restless, which explains why, as we talk to people across the nation over and over again, we hear questions like these. What does it all mean? Where am I going? Why don't things seem more worthwhile? And when we all work so hard and have so darn many things to play with? The question is, can your product fill this gap? The frustrated need for privacy in the family life, in this era of togetherness, was another secret wish uncovered in a depth survey. This need, however, might be used to sell a second car. In addition to the car the whole family enjoys together, the car for the husband and wife separately. Alone in the car, one may get the breathing spell one needs so badly, and may come to consider the car as one's castle or the instrument of one's reconquered privacy, or individual, personal, toothpaste, soap, shampoo. Another survey reported that there was a puzzling desexualization of married life, despite the great emphasis on marriage and family and sex. The problem: what can supply what the report diagnosed as a missing sexual spark? The solution: the report advised sellers to put the libido back into advertising. Despite the feeling that our manufacturers are trying to sell everything through sex, sex is found on TV commercials and ads in national magazines is too tame, the report said, too narrow. Consumerism is desexing the American libido because it has failed to reflect the powerful life forces in every individual, which range far beyond the relationship between the sexes. The sellers, it seemed, have sexed the sex out of sex. Most modern advertising reflects and grossly exaggerates our present national tendency to downgrade, simplify, and water down the passionate, turbulent, and electrifying aspects of the life urges of mankind. No one suggests that advertising can or should become obscene or salacious. The trouble lies with the fact that through its timidity and lack of imagination, it faces the danger of becoming libido poor and consequently unreal, inhuman, and tedious. How to put the libido back, restore the lost spontaneity, drive, love of life, the individuality that sex in America seems to lack. In an absent-minded moment, the report concludes that love of life is of the other sex, should remain unsoiled by exterior motives. Let the wife be more than a housewife, a woman. One day, having immersed myself in the varied insights these reports have been giving American advertisers for the last 15 years, I was invited to have lunch with the man who runs this motivational research operation. He had been so helpful in showing me the commercial forces behind the feminine mystique, perhaps I could be helpful to him. Naively, I asked why, since he found it so difficult to give women a true feeling of creativeness and achievement in housework, and tried to assuage their guilt and disillusion and frustrations by getting them to buy more things. Why didn't he encourage them to buy things for all they were worth, so they would have the time to get out of the home and pursue truly creative goals in the outside world? But we have helped her rediscover the home as the expression of her creativeness, he said. We help her think of the modern home as the artist's studio, the scientist's laboratory. Besides, he shrugged, most of the manufacturers we deal with are producing things which have to do with homemaking. In a free enterprise economy, he went on, we have to develop the need for new products. And to do that, we have to liberate women to desire these new products. We help them rediscover that homemaking is more creative than to compete with men. This can be manipulated. We sell them what they ought to want, speed up the unconscious, move it along. The big problem is to liberate the woman not to be afraid of what is going to happen to her if she doesn't have to spend so much time cooking, cleaning. That's what I mean, I said. Why doesn't the Pie Mix ad tell the woman she could use the time saved to be an astronomer? It wouldn't be too difficult, he replied. A few images, The astronomer gets her man, the astronomer as the heroine, make it glamorous for a woman to be an astronomer, but no, he shrugged again. The client would be too frightened. He wants to sell Pimax. The woman has to want to stay in the kitchen. The manufacturer wants to intrigue her back into the kitchen, and we show him how to do it the right way. If he tells her that all she can be is a wife and mother, she will spit in his face, but we show him how to tell her that it's creative to be in the kitchen. We liberate her need to be creative in the kitchen. If we tell her to be an astronomer, she might go too far from the kitchen. Besides, he added, if you wanted to have a campaign to liberate women to be astronomers, you'd have to find somebody like the National Education Association to pay for it. The motivational researchers must be given credit for their insights into the reality of the housewife's life and needs, a reality that often escaped their colleagues in academic sociology and therapeutic psychology, who saw women through the Freudian functional veil. To their own profit, and that of their clients, the manipulators discovered that millions of supposedly happy American housewives have complex needs which home and family, love and children, cannot fill. But by a morality that goes beyond the dollar, the manipulators are guilty of using their insights to sell women things which, no matter how ingenious, will never satisfy those increasingly desperate needs. They are guilty of persuading housewives to stay at home, mesmerized in front of a television set, their non-sexual human needs unnamed, unsatisfied, drained by the sexual cell into the buying of things. The manipulators and their clients in American business can hardly be accused of creating the feminine mystique, but they are the most powerful of its perpetuators. It is their millions which blanket the land with persuasive images, flattering the American housewife, diverting her guilt and disguising her growing sense of emptiness. They have done this so successfully, employing the techniques and concepts of modern social science and transposing them into those deceptively simple, clever, outrageous ads and commercials that an observer of the American scene today accepts as fact that the great majority of American women have no ambition other than to be housewives. If they are not solely responsible for sending women home, they are surely responsible for keeping them there. Their unremitting harangue is hard to escape in this day of mass communications. They have seared the feminine mystique deep into every woman's mind and into the minds of her husband, her children, her neighbors. They have made it part of the fabric of her everyday life, taunting her because she is not a better housewife, does not love her family enough, is growing old. Can a woman ever feel right cooking on a dirty range? Until today, no range could ever be kept really clean. Now new RCA Whirlpool ranges have oven doors that lift off, broiler drawers that can be cleaned at the sink, drip pans that slide out easily, the first range that any woman can keep completely clean easily, and make everything cooked taste better. Love is said in many ways. It's giving and accepting. It's protecting and selecting. Knowing what's safest for those you love. Their bathroom tissue is Scott tissue always. Now in four colors, and white. How skillfully they divert her need for achievement into sexual fantasies which promise her eternal youth, dulling her sense of passing time. They even tell her that she can make time stand still. Does she, or doesn't she? She's as full of fun as her kids, and just as fresh-looking. Her naturalness, the way her hair sparkles and catches the light, as though she's found the secret of making time stand still. And in a way, she has. With increasing skill, the ads glorify her role as an American housewife, knowing that her very lack of identity in that role will make her fall for whatever they are selling. Who is she? She gets as excited as her six-year-old about the opening of school. She reckons her days and trains met, lunches packed, fingers bandaged, and 1,001 details. She could be you, needing a special kind of clothes for your busy, rewarding life. Are you this woman, giving your kids the fun and advantages you want for them, taking them places and helping them do things, taking the part that's expected of you in church and community affairs, developing your talents so you'll be more interesting? You can be the woman you yearn to be, with a Plymouth all your own. Go where you want, when you want, in a beautiful Plymouth that's yours and nobody else's. But a new stove or softer toilet paper do not make a woman a better wife or mother, even if she thinks that's what she needs to be. Dyeing her hair cannot stop time. Buying a Plymouth will not give her a new identity. Smoking a Marlboro will not get her an invitation to bed, even if that's what she thinks she wants. But those unfulfilled promises can keep her endlessly hungry for things, keep her from ever knowing what she really needs or wants. A full-page ad in the New York Times, June 10, 1962, was dedicated to the woman who spends a lifetime living up to her potential. Under the picture of a beautiful woman, adorned by evening dress and jewels and two handsome children, it said, "The only totally integrated program of nutrient makeup and skincare, designed to lift a woman's good looks to their absolute peak, the woman who uses Ultima feels a deep sense of fulfillment, a new kind of pride. For this luxurious cosmetic collection is the ultimate. Beyond it, there is nothing." It all seems so ludicrous when you understand what they are up to. Perhaps the housewife has no one but herself to blame if she lets the manipulators flatter or threaten her into buying things that neither fill her family's needs nor her own. But if the ads and commercials are a clear case of caveat emptor, the same sexual cell disguised in the editorial content of a magazine or a television program is both less ridiculous and more insidious. Here the housewife is often an unaware victim. I have written for some of the magazines in which the sexual cell is inextricably linked with the editorial content. Consciously or unconsciously, the editors know what the advertiser wants. The heart of X Magazine is service. Complete service to the whole woman who is the American homemaker, service in all the areas of greatest interest to advertisers who are also businessmen. It delivers to the advertiser a strong concentration of serious, conscientious, dedicated homemakers, women more interested in the home and products for the home, women more willing and able to pay. A memo need never be written. A sentence need never be spoken at an editorial conference. The men and women who make the editorial decisions often compromise their own very high standards in the interests of the advertising dollar. Often, as a former editor of McCall's recently revealed, the advertiser's influence is less than subtle. The kind of home pictured in the service pages is dictated in no uncertain terms by the boys over in advertising. And yet, a company has to make a profit on its products. A magazine, a network needs advertising to survive. But even if profit is the only motive and the only standard of success, I wonder if the media are not making a mistake when they give the client what they think he wants. I wonder if the challenge and the opportunities for the American economy and for business itself might not in the long run lie in letting women grow up, instead of blanketing them with the youth serum that keeps them mindless and thing hungry. The real crime, no matter how profitable for the American economy, is the callous and growing acceptance of the manipulator's advice to get them young. The television commercials that children sing or recite even before they learn to read, the big beautiful ads almost as easy as, "Look, Sally, look," the magazines deliberately designed to turn teenage girls into housewife buyers of things before they grow up to be women. She reads X Magazine from beginning to end. She learns how to market, to cook, and to sew, and everything else a young woman should know. She plans her wardrobe around X Magazine's clothes, heeds X Magazine's counsel on beauty and bows, consults X Magazine for the latest teen fads, and oh, how she buys from those X Magazine ads. Buying habits start in X Magazine. It's easier to start a habit than to stop one. Learn how X Magazine's unique publication, X Magazine at School, carries your advertising into high school home economics classrooms. Like a primitive culture which sacrificed little girls to its tribal gods, we sacrifice our girls to the feminine mystique, grooming them ever more efficiently through the sexual cell to become consumers of the things to whose profitable sale our nation is dedicated. Two ads recently appeared in a national news magazine geared not to teenage girls but to executives who produce and sell things. One of them showed the picture of a boy. "I am so going to the moon, and you can't go because you're a girl. Children are growing faster today. Their interests can cover such a wide range, from roller skates to rockets. X Company 2 has grown with a broad spectrum of electronic products for worldwide governmental, industrial, and space application. The others show the face of a girl. Should a gifted child grow up to be a housewife? Educational experts estimate that the gift of high intelligence is bestowed upon only 1 out of every 50 children in our nation. When that gifted child is a girl, one question is inevitably asked. Will this rare gift be wasted if she becomes a housewife? Let these gifted girls answer that question themselves. Over 90% of them marry, and the majority find the job of being a housewife challenging and rewarding enough to make full use of all their intelligence, time, and energy. In her daily roles of nurse, educator, economist, and just plain housewife, she is constantly seeking ways to improve her family's life. Millions of women, shopping for half the families in America, do so by saving X stamps. If that gifted girl child grows up to be a housewife, can even the manipulator make supermarket stamps use all of her human intelligence, her human energy, in the century she may live, while that boy goes to the moon? Never underestimate the power of a woman, says another ad. But that power was and is underestimated in America. Or rather, it is only estimated in terms that can be manipulated at the point of purchase. Women's human intelligence and energy do not really figure in. And yet, they exist, to be used for some higher purpose than housework and thing buying, or wasted. Perhaps it is only a sick society, unwilling to face its own problems and unable to conceive of goals and purposes equal to the ability and knowledge of its members, that chooses to ignore the strength of women. Perhaps it is only a sick or immature society that chooses to make women housewives, not people. Perhaps it is only sick or immature men and women, unwilling to face the great challenges of society, who can retreat for long, without unbearable distress, into that thing-ridden house, and make it the end of life itself. Chapter 10. Housewifery expands to fill the time available. With a vision of the happy modern housewife as she is described by the magazines and television, by the functional sociologists, the sex-directed educators, and the manipulators dancing before my eyes, I went in search of one of those mystical creatures. Like Diogenes with his lamp, I went as a reporter from suburb to suburb, searching for a woman of ability and education who was fulfilled as a housewife. I went first to the suburban mental health centers and guidance clinics, to reputable local analysts, to knowledgeable local residents, and, stating my purpose, asked them to steer me not to the neurotic, frustrated housewives, but to the able, intelligent, educated women who were adjusted full-time housewives and mothers. I know many such housewives who have found fulfillment as women, one psychoanalyst said. I asked him to name 4 and went to see them. One, after 5 years of therapy, was no longer a driven woman, but neither was she a full-time housewife. She had become a computer programmer. The second was a gloriously exuberant woman with a fine, successful husband and 3 able, exuberant children. Throughout her married life, she had been a professional psychoanalyst. The third, between pregnancies, continued seriously her career as a dancer. And the fourth, after psychotherapy, was moving with an increasingly serious commitment into politics. I reported back to my guide and said that while all 4 seemed fulfilled women, none were full-time housewives, and 1, after all, was a member of his own profession. That's a coincidence with those 4, he said, but I wondered if it was a coincidence. In another community, I was directed to a woman who, my informant said, was truly fulfilled as a housewife. She even bakes her own bread. I discovered that during the years when her 4 children were under 6 and she wrote in the census blank, occupation housewife, she had learned a new language, with certification to teach, and had used her previous training in music first as a volunteer church organist and then as a paid professional. Shortly after I interviewed her, she took a teaching position. In many instances, however, the women I interviewed truly fitted the new image of feminine fulfillment. 4, 5, or 6 children baked their own bread, helped build the house with their own hands, sewed all their children's clothes. These women had no dreams of career, no visions of a world larger than the home. All energy was centered on their lives as housewives and mothers, their only ambition, their only dream already realized. But were they fulfilled women? In one upper-income development where I interviewed, there were 28 wives. Some were college graduates in their 30s or early 40s. The younger wives had usually quit college to marry. Their husbands were, to a rather high degree, engrossed in challenging professional work. Only one of these wives worked professionally. Most had made a career of motherhood with a dash of community activity. 19 out of the 28 had had natural childbirth. At dinner parties there, a few years ago, wives and husbands often got down on the floor to practice the proper relaxing exercises together. 20 of the 28 breastfed their babies. At or near 40, many of these women were pregnant. The mystique of feminine fulfillment was so literally followed in this community that if a little girl said, "When I grow up, I'm going to be a doctor," her mother would correct her, "No, dear, you're a girl. You're going to be a wife and mother like mommy." But what was mommy really like? 16 out of the 28 were in analysis or analytical psychotherapy. 18 were taking tranquilizers. Several had tried suicide. And some had been hospitalized for varying periods for depression or vaguely diagnosed psychotic states. You'd be surprised at the number of these happy suburban wives who simply go berserk one night and run shrieking through the street without any clothes on, said the local doctor, not a psychiatrist, who had been called in such emergencies. Of the women who breastfed their babies, one had continued desperately until the child was so undernourished that her doctor intervened by force. 12 were engaged in extramarital affairs, in fact, or in fantasy. These were fine, intelligent American women, to be envied for their homes, husbands, children, and for their personal gifts of mind and spirit. Why were so many of them driven women? Later, when I saw this same pattern repeated over and over again in similar suburbs, I knew it could hardly be coincidence. These women were alike mainly in one regard. They had uncommon gifts of intelligence and ability nourished by at least the beginnings of higher education. And the life they were leading as suburban housewives denied them the full use of their gifts. It was in these women that I first began to notice the telltale signs of the problem that has no name. Their voices were dull and flat, or nervous and jittery. They were listless and bored, or frantically busy around the house or community. They talked about fulfillment in the wife and mother terms of the mystique, but they were desperately eager to talk about this other problem, with which they seemed very familiar indeed. One woman had pioneered the search for good teachers in her community's backyard school system. She had served her term on the school board. When her children had all started school, she had thought seriously at 39 about her own future. Should she go back to college, get an MA, and become a professional teacher herself? But then, suddenly, she had decided not to go on. She had a late baby instead, her 5th. I heard that flat tone in her voice when she told me she had now retired from community leadership to major again in the home. I heard the same sad, flat tone in an older woman's voice as she told me, "I'm looking for something to satisfy me. I think it would be the most wonderful thing in the world to work, to be useful, but I don't know how to do anything. My husband doesn't believe in wives working. I'd cut off both my arms if I could have my children little and at home again. My husband says, find something to occupy yourself that you'll enjoy. Why should you work? So now I play golf nearly every day, just myself. When you walk 3-4 hours a day, at least you can sleep at night." I interviewed another woman in the huge kitchen of a house she had helped build herself. She was busily kneading the dough for her famous homemade bread. A dress she was making for her daughter was half-finished on the sewing machine. A hand loom stood in one corner. Children's art materials and toys were strewn all over the floor of the house, from front door to stove. In this expensive modern house, like many of the open-plan houses in this era, there was no door at all between kitchen and living room. Nor did this mother have any dream or wish or thought or frustration of her own to separate her from her children. She was pregnant now with her 7th. Her happiness was complete, she said, spending her days with her children. Perhaps here was a happy housewife. But just before I left, I said, as an afterthought, that I guess she was joking when she mentioned that she envied her neighbor, who was a professional designer as well as the mother of 3 children. "No, I wasn't joking," she said. And the serene housewife, kneading the dough for the bread she always made herself, started to cry. "I envy her terribly," she said. "She knows what she wants to do. I don't know. I never have. When I'm pregnant and the babies are little, I'm somebody, finally, a mother. But then they get older. I can't just keep on having babies." While I never found a woman who actually fitted that happy housewife image, I noticed something else about these able women who were leading their lives in the protective shade of the feminine mystique. They were so busy. Busy shopping, chauffeuring, using their dishwashers and dryers and electric mixers, busy gardening, waxing, polishing, helping with the children's homework, collecting for mental health, and doing thousands of little chores. In the course of my interviews with these women, I began to see that there was something peculiar about the time housework takes today. On one suburban road, there were two colonial houses, each with a big, comfortable living room, a small library, a formal dining room, a big, cheerful kitchen, four bedrooms, an acre of garden and lawn, and in each family, one commuting husband and three school-aged children. Both houses were well kept, with a cleaning woman 2 days a week, but the cooking and the other housework was done by the wife, who in each case was in her late 30s, intelligent, healthy, attractive, and well-educated. In the first house, Mrs. W., a full-time housewife, was busy most of every day with cooking, cleaning, shopping, chauffeuring, taking care of the children. Next door, Mrs. D., a microbiologist, got most of these chores done before she left for her laboratory at 9 or after she got home at 5:30. In neither family were the children neglected, though Mrs. D.'s were slightly more self-reliant. Both women entertained a fair amount. Mrs. W., the housewife, did a lot of routine community work, but she did not have time to take a policy-making office, which she was often offered as an intelligent, capable woman. At most, she headed a committee to run a dance or a PTA fair. Mrs. D., the scientist, did no routine community work, but, in addition to her job and home, played in a dedicated string quintet. Music was her main interest outside of science, and held a policy-making post in the World Affairs Organization, which had been an interest since college. How could the same-size house in the same-size family, under almost identical conditions of income, outside help, style of life, take so much more of Mrs. W.'s time than of Mrs. D.'s? And Mrs. W. was never idle, really. She never had time in the evening to just read, as Mrs. D. often did. In a large modern apartment building in a big eastern city, there were 2 6-room apartments, both a little untidy, except when the cleaning woman had just left or before a party. Both the G's and the R's had 3 children under 10, one still a baby. Both husbands were in their early 30s, and both were in demanding professional work. But Mr. G., whose wife is a full-time housewife, was expected to do and did much more housework when he got home at night or on Saturday than Mr. R., whose wife was a freelance illustrator and evidently had to get the same amount of housework done in between the hours she spent in her drawing table. Mrs. G. somehow couldn't get her housework done before her husband came home at night and was so tired then that he had to do it. Why did Mrs. R., who did not count the housework as her main job, get it done in so much less time? I noticed this pattern again and again as I interviewed women who defined themselves as housewives and compared them to the few who pursued professions part or full-time. The same pattern held even where both housewife and professional had full-time domestic help. The more often, the housewives chose to do their own housework full-time, even when they could well afford 2 servants. But I also discovered that many frantically busy full-time housewives were amazed to find that they could polish off in 1 hour the housework that used to take them 6, or was still undone at dinner time as soon as they started studying or working or had some other serious interest outside the home. Toying with the question, how can 1 hour of housework expand to fill 6 hours, same house, same work, same wife, I came back again to the basic paradox of the feminine mystique. That it emerged to glorify woman's role as housewife at the very moment when the barriers to her full participation in society were lowered, at the very moment when science and education and her own ingenuity made it possible for a woman to be both wife and mother and to take an active part in the world outside the home. The glorification of woman's role, then, seems to be in proportion to society's reluctance to treat women as complete human beings. For the less real function that role has, the more it is decorated with meaningless details to conceal its emptiness. This phenomenon has been noted in general terms in the annals of social science and in history, the chivalry of the Middle Ages, for example, and the artificial pedestal of the Victorian woman. But it may come as somewhat of a shock to the emancipated American woman to discover that it applies in a concrete and extreme degree to the housewife situation in America today. Did the new mystique of separate but equal femininity arise because the growth of women in America could no longer be repressed by the old mystique of feminine inferiority? Could women be prevented from realizing their full capabilities by making their role in the home equal to man's role in society? Women's places in the home could no longer be said in tones of contempt. Housework, washing dishes, diaper changing had to be dressed up by the new mystique to become equal to splitting atoms, penetrating outer space, creating art that illuminates human destiny, pioneering on the frontiers of society. It had to become the very end of life itself to conceal the obvious fact that it is barely the beginning. When you look at it this way, the double deception of the feminine mystique becomes quite apparent. Number one, the more a woman is deprived of function in society at the level of her own ability, the more her housework, mother work, wife work will expand, and the more she will resist finishing her housework or mother work and being without any function at all. Evidently, human nature also abhors a vacuum, even in women. Number two, the time required to do the housework for any given woman varies inversely with the challenge of the other work to which she is committed. Without any outside interests, a woman is virtually forced to devote her every moment to the trivia of keeping house. The simple principle that work expands to fill the time available was first formulated by the Englishman C. Northcote Parkinson on the basis of his experience with the administrative bureaucracy in World War II. Parkinson's law can easily be reformulated for the American housewife. Housewifery expands to fill the time available, or motherhood expands to fill the time available, or even sex expands to fill the time available. This is, without question, the true explanation for the fact that even with all the new labor-saving appliances, the modern American housewife probably spends more time on housework than her grandmother. It is also part of the explanation for a national preoccupation with sex and love, and for the continued baby boom. Tabling for the moment the sexual implications, which are vast, let's consider some of the dynamics of the law itself as an explanation for the disposal of feminine energy in America, to go back several generations. I have suggested that the real cause, both of feminism and of women's frustration, was the emptiness of the housewife's role. The major work and decisions of society were taking place outside the home, and women felt the need or fought for the right to participate in this work. If women had gone on to use their newly won education and find new identity in this work outside the home, the mechanics of housewifery would have taken the same subsidiary place in their lives as car and garden and workbench in man's life. Motherhood, wifehood, sexual love, family responsibility would merely have acquired a new emotional importance as they have for men. Many observers have noticed the new joy American men have been taking in their children as their own work week is shortened, without that edge of anger women whose children are their work seem to feel. But when the mystique of feminine fulfillment sent women back home again, housewifery had to expand into a full-time career. Sexual love and motherhood had to become all of life, had to use up to dispose of women's creative energies. The very nature of family responsibility had to expand to take the place of responsibility to society. As this began to happen, each labor-saving appliance brought a labor-demanding elaboration of housework. Each scientific advance that might have freed women from the drudgery of cooking, cleaning, and washing, thereby giving her more time for other purposes, instead imposed new drudgery until housework not only expanded to fill the time available, but could hardly be done in the available time. The automatic clothes dryer does not save a woman the 4 or 5 hours a week she used to spend at the clothesline if, for instance, she runs her washing machine and dryer every day. After all, she still has to load and unload the machine herself, sort the clothes, and put them away. As the young mother said, clean sheets twice a week are now possible. Last week when my dryer broke down, the sheets didn't get changed for 8 days. Everyone complained. We all felt dirty. I felt guilty. Isn't that silly? The modern American housewife spends far more time washing, drying, and ironing than her mother. If she has an electric freezer or mixer, she spends more time cooking than a woman who does not have these labor-saving appliances. The home freezer, simply by existing, takes up time. Beans, raised in the garden, must be prepared for freezing. If you have an electric mixer, you have to use it. Those elaborate recipes with the pureed chestnuts, watercress, and almonds take longer than broiling lamb chops. According to a Bryn Mawr survey made just after the war, in a typical United States farm family, housework took 60.55 hours a week, 78.35 hours in cities under 100,000, 80.57 in cities of over 100,000. With all their appliances, the suburban and city housewives spend more time on housework than the busy farmer's wife. That farmer's wife, of course, has quite a lot of other work to do. In the 1950s, sociologists and home economists reported puzzlement and baffling inconsistencies as to the amount of time American women were still spending on housework. Study after study revealed that American housewives were spending almost as many or even more hours a day on housekeeping as women 30 years earlier, despite the smaller, easy-to-care-for homes, and despite the fact that they had seven times as much capital equipment and housekeeping appliances. There were, however, some exceptions. Women who worked many hours a week outside the home, either in paid jobs or community work, did the housekeeping, on which the full-time housewife still spends 60 hours a week in half the time. They still seem to do all the homemaking activities of the housewife, meals, shopping, cleaning, the children. But even with a 35-hour work week on the job, their work week was only an hour and a half a day longer than the housewives. That this strange phenomenon caused so little comment was due to the relative scarcity of such women. For the even stranger phenomenon, the real significance of which the mystique hid was the fact that, despite the growth of the American population and the movement of that population from farm to city with the parallel growth of American industry and professions, in the first 50 years of the 20th century, the proportion of American women working outside the home increased very little indeed, while the proportion of American women in the professions actually declined. From nearly half the nation's professional force in 1930, women had dropped to only 35% in 1960, despite the fact that the number of women college graduates had nearly tripled. The phenomenon was the great increase in the numbers of educated women choosing to be just housewives. And yet, for the suburban and city housewife, the fact remains that more and more of the jobs that used to be performed in the home have been taken away. Canning, baking bread, weaving cloth and making clothes, educating the young, nursing the sick, taking care of the aged. It is possible for women to reverse history, or kid themselves that they can reverse it, by baking their own bread. But the law does not permit them to teach their own children at home, and few housewives would match their so-called generalist skill with the professional expertise of doctor and hospital to nurse a child through tonsillitis or pneumonia at home. There is a real basis, then, for the complaint that so many housewives have. I feel so empty somehow, useless, as if I don't exist. At times I feel as though the world is going past my door while I just sit and watch. This very sense of emptiness, this uneasy denial of the world outside the home, often drives the housewife to even more effort, more frantic housework, to keep the future out of sight. And the choices the housewife makes to fill that emptiness, though she seems to make them for logical and necessary reasons, trap her further in trivial domestic routine. The woman with two children, for example, bored and restive in her city apartment, is driven by her sense of futility and emptiness to move, for the children's sake, to a spacious house in the suburbs. The house takes longer to clean. The shopping and gardening and chauffeuring and do-it-yourself routines are so time-consuming that, for a while, the emptiness seems solved. But when the house is furnished and the children are in school and the family's place in the community has gelled, there is nothing to look forward to, as one woman I interviewed put it. The empty feeling returns, and so she must redecorate the living room or wax the kitchen floor more often than necessary or have another baby. Diapering that baby, along with all the other housework, may keep her running so fast that she will indeed need her husband's help in the kitchen at night. Yet none of it is quite as real, quite as necessary as it seems. One of the great changes in America since World War II has been the explosive movement to the suburbs, those ugly and endless sprawls which are becoming a national problem. Sociologists point out that a distinguishing feature of these suburbs is the fact that the women who live there are better educated than city women, and that the great majority are full-time housewives. At first glance, one might suspect that the very growth and existence of the suburbs causes educated modern American women to become and remain full-time housewives. Or did the post-war suburban explosion come, at least in part, as a result of the coincidental choice of millions of American women to seek fulfillment in the home? Among the women I interviewed, the decision to move to the suburbs for the children's sake followed the decision to give up job or profession and become a full-time housewife, usually after the birth of the first baby or the second, depending on the age of the woman when the mystique hit. With the youngest of wives, of course, the mystique hit so early that the choice of marriage and motherhood as a full-time career ruled out education for any profession, and the move to the suburbs came with marriage or as soon as the wife no longer had to work to support her husband through college or law school. Families where the wife intends to pursue a definite professional goal are less likely to move to the suburbs. In the city, of course, there are more and better jobs for educated women. More universities, sometimes free, with evening courses geared to men who work during the day, and often more convenient than the conventional daytime program for a young mother who wants to finish college or work toward a graduate degree. There is also a better supply of full or part-time nurses and cleaning help, nursery schools, daycare centers, after-school play programs. But these considerations are only important to the woman who has commitments outside the home. There is also less room for housewifery to expand to fill the time available in the city. That sense of restless marking time comes early to the educated, able city housewife, even though, when her babies are little, the time is more than filled with busyness, wheeling the carriage back and forth in the park, sitting on the playground bench because the children can't play outside alone. Still, there's no room in the city apartment for a home freezer, no garden to grow beans in. And all the organizations in the city are so big, the library is already built, professionals run the nursery schools and recreation programs. It is not surprising, then, that many young wives vote for a move to the suburbs as soon as possible. Like the empty plains of Kansas that tempted the restless immigrant, the suburbs in their very newness and lack of structured service offered, at least at first, a limitless challenge to the energy of educated American women. The women who were strong enough, independent enough, seized the opportunity and were leaders and innovators in these new communities. But, in most cases, these were women educated before the era of feminine fulfillment. The ability of suburban life to fulfill or truly use the potential of the able, educated American woman seems to depend on her own previous autonomy or self-realization. That is, on her strength to resist the pressures to conform, resist the time-filling busy work of suburban house and community, and find or make the same kind of serious commitment outside the home that she would have made in the city. Such a commitment in the suburbs, in the beginning at least, was likely to be on a volunteer basis, but it was challenging and necessary. When the mystique took over, however, a new breed of women came to the suburbs. They were looking for sanctuary. They were perfectly willing to accept the suburban community as they found it. Their only problem was how to fit in. They were perfectly willing to fill their days with the trivia of housewifery. Women of this kind, and most of those that I interviewed, were of the post-1950 college generation, refused to take policy-making positions in community organizations. They will only collect for Red Cross or March of Dimes or Scouts or be den mothers or take the lesser PTA jobs. Their resistance to serious community responsibility is usually explained by, "I can't take the time for my family." But much of their time is spent in meaningless busy work. The kind of community work they choose does not challenge their intelligence or even sometimes fill a real function, nor do they derive much personal satisfaction from it. But it does fill time. So increasingly, in the new bedroom suburbs, the really interesting volunteer jobs, the leadership of the cooperative nurseries, the free libraries, the school board posts, the selectmanships, and in some suburbs, even the PTA presidencies, are filled by men. The housewife who doesn't have time to take serious responsibility in the community, like the woman who doesn't have time to pursue a professional career, evades a serious commitment through which she might finally realize herself. She evades it by stepping up her domestic routine until she is truly trapped. The dimensions of the trap seem physically unalterable, as the busyness that fills the housewife's day seems inescapably necessary. But is that domestic trap an illusion, despite its all-too-solid reality, an illusion created by the feminine mystique? Take, for instance, the open plan of the contemporary ranch or split-level house, $14,990 to $54,990, which has been built in the millions from Roslyn Heights to the Pacific Palisades. They give the illusion of more space for less money. But the women to whom they are sold almost have to live the feminine mystique. There are no true walls or doors. The woman in the beautiful electronic kitchen is never separated from her children. She need never feel alone for a minute, need never be by herself.